accession number 18463, reel 7.
Dunbar, reel 7.
And the CO came along, and he wasn't very impressed with these beers at all, and he gave John Willoughby a reprimand. Get your men shaved straight away, will you, because we shaved every day without fail, whilst of course the Americans never did. The average American infantryman was not combat ready unless he had a beard, and they took it a bit of a surprise when we shaved every day. Anyway, we marched off. Unfortunately, of course, got our feet wet because the stream went across the road, and went on with wet feet, which is a little bit annoying always. And went on for about a mile, I guess, mile and a half, where we could look back on our hills. 282 was still alight, and stopped for a while. And we went off to the side, and in fact, it obviously had been a gook signal station or something, because they pushed a long crucifix bayonet down into the ground and used it as an aerial lead. We stopped there for a while, and the Argyles then marched past us, and one of the CSMs came over and said that they'd been up on 282, and they'd found a couple of their chaps tied to the trees and bayoneted. Now, we'll never know. I mean, maybe they were dead and they were bayoneted, and it sounds most likely that they were, and they just tied two bodies up and bayoneted. There were two men missing, and they remained missing until after we returned, the Argyles returned from Korea, when they were posted as killed. Whether it was them or not, I've no idea. And I don't think anybody does. I don't think anybody ever will know, and doesn't want to, perhaps. Anyway, transport then came up for us, and we climbed onto these lorries and drove off, and then went past the Argyles who were marching. It was quite a sad time, really, because there didn't seem to be too many of them. You know, there was only about 200 of them left. And there wasn't the usual banter. You get a lot of banter between the two battalions, and I don't think any of us called out. We might have given them a little wave, but that was about all. And we drove then down into Songju. It was quite a drive, actually. We abandoned guns. We passed over a bridge and a river which had not been destroyed. The bridge hadn't been destroyed, and there were abandoned tanks, the odd guns and things. On the side I looked, somebody told me on the other side where I wasn't looking, there were actually lines of artillery lined up that had been napalm, but I didn't see that myself. Went into Songju, and there were guns all over the place there, which had just been abandoned. And we went up on a little hill overlooking a valley and dug in, all reasonably quiet. And that night, that evening, we had the sad news that Joe Pentany, our friend from 4 Platoon, had died of his wounds in Japan. And couldn't really believe it, because he'd been so chipper when he was wounded and came down. And the following day, we started long-range patrols. The first one was going to be on transport. That was battalion transport. That was anything that moved, literally, because we didn't have any troop-carrying transport. We didn't have any artillery, engineers, troop-carrying transport, anything at all. So we paraded down on an enormous great square. It was like a parade square. I don't know what it was, in actual fact, and it was surrounded by guns. All guns were being brought in and placed around this square. There must have been about 100 of them, and we're down there with a company commander, and incidentally John Shipster had a fantastic idea that we should all go out in shorts with their what we call socks rolled down. That's like boots with socks rolled down over the top of it. And it was the coldest day we'd had yet, and we were freezing. The only person who had long trousers on was Major Allen, the OC, company OC. And suddenly, as he's talking to the CO, John Shipster drives in with a Jeep all full of himself, towing another gun, because apparently it was him who was bringing all these guns and putting them around this square. And Andrew Mann said to him, "John, get rid of that bloody pop gun at this minute." Poor old John went away a little bit chastened, in his shorts, of course. So we climbed on these carriers, and it was the coldest patrol I ever did. It was so cold I couldn't remember very little about it, except that we were clinging on to 1500 weights and 3 tonners on the tailboards and on the sides and bonnets, and we went off on this patrol. As we went through past a village, the villagers began throwing apples at us. And I don't know whether it was a friendly gesture or whether they didn't really take a fancy to us at all. But these things were coming in like bullets and hitting. We were quite pleased to get past there. But there was an abandoned Russian, North Korean lorry there, and an abandoned tank. So I guess the NK had been there at some time. And we came back from that patrol. And then the following day, our platoon alone, 6th platoon alone, were driven out in transport to a road junction, and then we marched for, I'd guess, about 10 miles out through country where the North Koreans had withdrawn. And the roads are absolutely littered with these epaulettes, as if they'd been tearing off their epaulettes and throwing them away, and they probably had, in actual fact. And in fact, we found a Bren gun barrel there, funny enough, and we eventually brought it back because we thought it was an Argyle one. And it wasn't, so I've no idea where that came from. We marched on round a bend, and there were wooden posts sticking up out the ground, wooden mines. They just dug these wooden mines in round the corner. It was obvious that they had them covered, but they'd all gone. They'd all vanished. And we went on a little bit farther to a village, and Gus decided to stop there the night, and we expected him to dig us in on the surrounding little hills, but unfortunately he didn't. He placed us all in a little paddy field there, and we had a fairly worrying night because we expected to be shot up at any moment. Because on the far side there was a great crest, and it was literally shale. You'd never been able to climb up it. And on the top were a few trees, and there were birds up there, obviously being disturbed. There aren't many birds in Korea. In fact, I only saw them then and the following year. And there were very few birds. And these birds were flying up and down, and we wanted to send a patrol up, and he wouldn't have that. I mean, he had his orders, presumably, and I really don't know the ins and outs of it. And we stayed there the night. Nobody did attack us. Following morning, he decided to send a patrol forward, and he would go with it. And my section was chosen. But by this time, I'd found that the bank of this little stream was mined. On the far bank, they'd got anti-personnel mines all along there. And Gus had a team of villagers. The bridge had been blown, and he was filling in the stream just so you could get a jeep across. We hadn't got a jeep, but I mean, anybody following up. Anyway, we went over and across. We were just about to cross the stream, and he said, "Watch out for mines." So we went across. The section commanders went across with him and went about 20 yards up the mine. He said then, "Well, we don't need the section. We'll go on, and we'll see what's happening." There's thick fog, incidentally, I might tell you. There had been heavy rain all night. Now we've got thick fog in the morning. You can't see more than 20 yards ahead of you. And I said to my section, "Go back over the river, but take care. There might be mines." So we go on about 20 yards. I look back, and there they are. They won't go back. They won't go back over the river, and I lost my temper with them. And I ran back, and I pranced all over these stones and said rude words to them, and they were a bit upset. And they came back over and went their way, and we went on at the top of the road and lost ourselves in the fog and found a T-junction. And on the opposite side of the road there was a house, and sitting out on the veranda was an old Korean smoking his pipe. But this was obviously the main drag in which the North Korean transport and tanks had gone up, because there's lots of tank tracks and stuff like that up. And that's how we finished our day. And we went back the way we came, got picked up and taken back to camp. And it's rather strange there, because I remember this so clearly. Albert Critchley, who was our platoon sergeant, they got into an argument about whether we deserved a medal for Korea, you see, because it seemed like it was coming to an end at the moment. And I was saying, "Well, you can't have a medal for this, And he was saying, "Well, during the war, we did this, that, and the other." And this question of the medal came up, and it was just a conversation between people. And we went back, and the following day, 6th Platoon was sent off to Wagwan Bridge. There was apparently at this time the Eighth Army was concerned that with all their people having, because the whole of the South Korea was deserted as far as we were concerned, there wasn't an American anywhere to be seen, or South Korean for that matter, and they were concerned that the North Koreans were reforming, and they were going to make a tank attack on the bridges at Wagwan. And we went off down there with an anti-tank gun and dug in on the edge of the road. But we were, unfortunately, we couldn't go anywhere because the whole area was mined. And the following day, we spent that night there, the following day, an Australian platoon took over, an Australian anti-tank gun. And unfortunately, they were a bit blasé and drove a carrier straight into the orchard. And I don't know if this is true, but there was a bit of a bang. And I know a couple were killed there. And one of the corporals, Australian corporal, came along and said, "Oh, it's nothing to worry about. Platoon commander just had his head blown off," and they all laughed. And we thought, oh, these are a bit of a rough old crowd. And I got talking to one of them, and I said to him, "We got a bit of a problem," I said, "because we can't tell north from south, you know, Koreans." And he said, "Oh, it's no problem. That's no problem at all." And I thought, "Oh, he's an expert, you know, been in the jungles of New Guinea and what have you." I said, "Well, how are you going to tell them?" He said, "It doesn't matter. We kill them all." And of course, they've been prisoners, a lot of them, and fought in New Guinea, and they didn't have any time north or south, this particular body that were there then. And so I'm afraid we were a little bit feeling very junior, you know, having felt like veterans. We suddenly realised we were just kids at play, sort of thing, you see. And we went back down the road then, and the whole battalion then had moved into some paddy fields, because the word had come that we were to change into BD from JG, and the kit bags came up, and we got out our battle dress and our long johns and pullovers, and no, we had our pullovers with us actually, and all our winter kit, dressed in BD, and shoved the JG in the, well, most of us did, because a lot of the kit bags had been looted, some were missing, and there were some who unfortunately had to stay in Jungle Green. Not many, I guess 4 or 5, despite all the stories that you'll read and hear about. I don't think there was more than 4 or 5 in our company. And one of those, unfortunately, was poor old Chris Lawrence, because being about 6'3", he couldn't share, because they spread out the casualties, uniforms amongst everybody. We had the rather amusing situation where Jimmy Wilde, the Sergeant Major, loaned his best battle dress to his signaller and wouldn't let him take his crowns off. And we had a signaller walking about with the CSM's crowns. And sometime later, this signaller, apparently a big lump of water bomb, lay flat, hit him flat on his chest. And it was reputed that Jimmy Wilde rang up and said, "How's my battle dress? How's my battle dress?" Well, these are anecdotal stories. I don't know whether they're true or not. But that was much later. Anyway, the kit bags were taken off, and we loaded souvenirs in it, I might add. And my friend, I should never have done this, but he was banging anti-tank shells, long anti-tank shells, into his kit bag, you see, and he couldn't get them all in. He said to me, "Oh, could you put a couple in yours?" I said, "Oh, I can't put that sort of rubbish in there, can I?" I'd already got a few, you know, pretty rounds and a bayonet and other sort of things in there, and some badges. And he insisted, and I think I felt a bit sorry for him, because he was a chap whose section I'd taken over after this little misdemeanor back in the below Songdo. And I stuck a couple of these anti-tank shells down the side of my kit. I knew it was a mistake, and it was. And because they all went back, and we put our spare boots in there, and they had to, when they got them back to Busan, before they went off to Japan or wherever they went to, the kit bags, they had to unload them all and get the spare boots out, because, you know, we were boots being the wear out. And of course, they also unloaded all their little souvenirs and things like that. And in fact, when I eventually got my kit bag back, it had nothing in it except a wet shirt. So, and I think, funny enough, was that Bills came back with all his stuff except his shells in it. I was a little bit annoyed about that. That's going on a bit. Anyway, the following day, we were flying up now. We're going up by air to Kimpo. Went down we were driven down to Taegu. We were about the last, I think, the middle six. Everybody had virtually gone. And we eventually got down there by a very, very devious route. There was, I can't remember, it was probably mines or something like that. Or it might have been that the MSRs going north, you had to stay off them because everything was going north. Nobody was anxious to stay in South Korea. We got down to the airport, and there was quite a long delay, and eventually our turn came to get on an aeroplane. It was getting a little bit dusk by that time. And they were airborne aircraft, and we jumped on the... we went over to the back of this aircraft, which was opened up. There had been some problems with the aircraft during the day, fuel and tails falling off and things like that. And we all had to get dressed in parachutes. And, of course, the word came then that we were jumping onto Kempo, you know, and they put us all into these parachutes. And what do they do? You get into this harness, and they were not airborne parachutes. They were the airman type where you sort of sit on them, you know, sit on the pack, and they sort of walk round then. Of course, they tighten up all the straps, and you're sort of, you know, you feel as if you're like that. And we eventually got on the plane, and it was a... seats round the side of this aircraft, and all the kit was put in the middle, and a great net put over it to hold it all free. And the captain came back and said, if you have to jump out on the way up, I'll drop the tail off. Apparently you could drop the complete tail off of this aircraft, and you just run out the back, count whatever it was, and pull the ripcord, you know. And it was a ripcord one, it wasn't a static line chute. Anyway, on the way up, everybody got a bit blasé, and there were little holes in the windows, had little holes in them, and you took out this little plug, and they had little sea ration tins, and they would just go through here, and they were bouncing them off the tail of the plane, so they could bounce them off, you know. Anyway, we eventually arrived up there about 5 o'clock in the morning, I guess. It was bright sunlight. Got off the plane and began to march off the airfield, and there was a most enormous stack of rations I've ever seen in all my life, then or since, at any time. C4 rations, much piled higher than a house and as far as the eye could see, with guards around about 10 meter intervals, with armed guards all around. And I could see our line went over, veered over, and then picked up a box of rations and went on. And, you know, the NCOs didn't pick them up. We just got a couple of the chaps to get a couple of packs of C4 rations. Guards never took any notice. And the column literally went over, weaved over to this great pile of rations, picked up a number of things, and off we went. And we were given to allocate a little spot on the edge of the airfield with some destroyed buildings all around us. And we packed all these rations up. I think we had about 10 boxes, which had... I guess they must have had 10 boxes in each, 5 or 10 boxes in each, however many, up in the middle of the thing. Then we thought, well, I guess that's air rations, left them. And then we began to look around the camp. The Marines had moved out, because you know the story of instead of putting 10 Corps with 8th Army, MacArthur had decided to do another amphibious landing up the coast, which is all a bit of a mess. But anyway, they'd all moved out. The airborne had gone, and there was this tented place over there, and there were showers and meals. You could go and we could have gone every half hour and had a meal. Just walked in, took a great plateful of stuff, went off and ate it. You could have had as much as you like. Showers, and then somebody came back and said, "Hey, there's a stores over here where you can get anything you like." And we were not as brave as all that, so we all went and got a sleeping bag. Because that's what we wanted. We couldn't carry anything else, you see. And you walked up, there's a great queue, and you went up, got up to the front of the queue, and the old gum-chewing storeman said, "What do you want, Mac?" "Sleeping bag, please." Right, yeah. And you signed your name, Mickey Mouse, MacArthur's, and all these sort of silly names were being signed on this scribble of pencil. And he didn't take any, he wasn't interested at all. But just ahead of me, there was this American came up, and he wanted a great mountain of clothing like this, you know. And the chap said to him, "Hey, Mac, you were here yesterday." He said, "And a day before." He said, "Well, wow, what about it then, you know? Aren't you going to give it to me?" "Yeah, okay then." They got this mountain. They must have been selling it somewhere, I suppose. But what we found out later was we missed out a little bit, because just round the corner was an armory. And all the officers had found this, and they were drawing 45s and shoulder holsters and all the paraphernalia that they wanted. Every one of them had a 45 from then on. But we missed out on that. And I'm sure we could have impersonated an officer and got a 45 had we known. We stayed there, 3 or 4 days we stayed there, till the transport called us up. The road party, all the transport that could, went by road. And eventually we were then sent off. I'm not quite sure how this happened. I believe it was only B Company. The war diary says that the companies were sent out on a route march. Now, I can't remember that at all. I remember us going off in trucks, and we stayed by this railway line, and we were going to attack up a narrow gully, a road rather, you know, which went between some hills, and there was artillery there, and they were all dug in on this hill, and John Shipster, of course, again came up and said, "Well, let's light some fires." He said, "Oh, that'll draw fire." He said, "That's good. We'll know what they're there then." But you know, fortunately, the company commander had a better idea, and we didn't light the fires. We stayed the night there. Very, very cold. Thick frost all over the underside of our ponchos in the morning. And then apparently something had gone a bit adrift. We didn't do this attack. The Australian transport had come out. They had a lot more transport than us. Unloaded and came and picked us up. And they gave us a hair-raising drive back to wherever it was the brigade was concentrating. And then we had a fairly hectic time of going up valleys and going the wrong way. And by virtue of the fact that the staff, you know, above brigade level, didn't know that these were gullies which didn't go anywhere, and the rocks, 1st Division was on our right, began to cross our front, and, you know, it was sort of mistaken identity. We were, after a lot of kerfuffle, we were withdrawn back, and we moved on then to either Caisson or Cumchon. I can't remember the name now at this moment. I've got it, but I can't remember what the name
probably
was.
Probably Caisson.
Probably Caisson, yeah. We went to Caisson, which was a village, and we stopped there. Quite a hefty little town that. It hadn't been really very badly damaged, and we stayed the night on the edge of it. And just over there was a ploughed field. On the other side of it was a new wooden building with a North Korean flag flying on it. And I sent Bill over to get to have a look and see what it was. And it turned out to be sort of a hospital building with this flag still flying up there. And we just couldn't work out what this lone building was doing over the other side of this ploughed field. And we came to the conclusion later that it was probably been a landing strip, and they ploughed it up before they'd withdrawn. But the instruments were thrown all over the place, all new instruments. And in a great barn there was full of German jackboots, German army jackboots. They were presumably too big. I suppose the Russians captured them, gave them to the North Koreans. They were too big for North Korean feet, and they just got thrown into this barn and left. And I found a bunker full of either North Korean or Russian officers' epaulets. Again, I brought a few samples of them back, and I gave to the National Army in recent years. And I collected a few of those up, plus a photograph of a North Korean officer's funeral. And the brigadier came and talked to us there and told us that the following day the brigade was going to lead the advance. At last we'd got a route to the north. And the following day, I can't remember who was the lead. Well, how this advance from now on, how this works out is that the lead battalion of the day, the following day would go to the rear and you'd move up, and the same thing would happen with the companies, same thing would happen with the platoons. So every 3 days you were at the front, albeit you might not be in the front of the actual column, but you were in the front of the company, and the companies would move up through, so that you never had more than, except on the third day, when you'd be leading your company, or maybe your battalion, or what have you. And then we began the advance then to, first of all, Sariwon, which was said to have been the Aldershot North Korean Aldershot of the town. The Argyles were leading the way on that particular day, and we were at the back bringing up the rear. And the lead would be on tanks, and then the lead platoon on tanks, and the other two platoons in lorries. So if you were lead platoon, you were on the tanks, otherwise you were packed into lorries. And Sariwon, we stopped short of Sariwon at a place where there was a rather horrible little incident. A woman there had been caught in crossfire and killed, and her two children were around the body there. And unfortunately, this particular photograph was on breakfast tables all over the world the following morning. A very sad event, that. She'd been caught, I don't know by whether by us or the North Koreans, but she'd been caught in crossfire and killed. And there was now we didn't know this at the time, but there was getting a bit of a shambles because the American staff were landing their Austers on the road and getting in the way of things and trying to take over the advance. Because Sariwon, whoever the order had been given, that whichever division captured Sariwon would lead the way to Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. And of course, the 1st Cavalry, which we were with, were anxious to get it. The 24th Division were coming up another road. They were anxious to get it. And the staff officers were falling over themselves to keep everybody going. They weren't terribly interested in the conduct of the battle, you know. Anyway, the Argyles captured Sariwon. And we drew up close behind Sariwon the following morning. And the prisoners coming down, quite incredible. They were fit young men, cropped hair, all in their uniforms had been stripped off, and they got these white civilian style clothes on and underneath, and they were marching in column about eight abreast down the road there, looking pretty, you know, proud of themselves, although they were prisoners. And then a load of lorries came through, American lorries came through, and the prisoners here were sitting in with their heads bowed in the old typical Korean way. And guards were on the back. And I annoyed me a little bit because there wasn't anything we could do about it. But the guards were hitting them, you know, with their carbine butts and things like that. There was no need for that. And we passed through Sariwon, which was still burning pretty well, very badly burnt, in actual fact, partially destroyed. And we passed a lorry full of, had straw all around the edge. And it had crashed into a building, and there were dead hanging out of it all over the place. And this apparently had been driven into the Argyles the previous night, and they had a little bit of a shindig there. It's in their history. Went on, and the road now became covered, absolutely covered with everything you could think of that was North Korean: badges, jackets, weapons, burp guns, a lot. And that apparently was the place where the Australians had taken a whole lot of prisoners by various means. We went on then, and it all now becomes rather blurred because the ground was so dry that you drove in an absolute mask of dust all the time. Thick dust, choking dust. Had to put tie something around your nose, and if you could, you scrounged American goggles. I managed to scrounge a pair, but they were very rare. And every night you were covered in this yellow, thick yellow dust, weapons, everything filthy. And we'd travel all day and then just stop at night until we'd come to some sort of place or other, you know, which was considered to be a concentration area. And this went on with us in the lead, the cab in the lead, and